Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first case, 2023-0156, the matter of the State of Ohio versus Eli Carter. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Szymanski. Good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy and fellow justices of the court. I'd like to reserve approximately 10 minutes of my argument, please, for rebuttal. First and foremost, Eli Carter is eternally grateful for the court's willingness to hear this most important matter. I don't think it's any secret that confrontation and the right to confront your accusers face-to-face in a criminal justice setting is paramount. And regrettably, what occurred here was a situation where the trial court made a generalized finding that travel was difficult and therefore permitted this remote testimony, which completely flies in the face of the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court mandate set forth in Maryland versus Craig. We've outlined those issues very succinctly and accurately. We have correctly referenced the record for the court's consideration. And to the extent that there's any question mark about the issue in this case, it has nothing to do with COVID or the spread of COVID or the pandemic or who wore a mask or who didn't. The court found that the witness in question's travel was impracticable or difficult because of weather conditions.
Counselor, can I stop you right there first to just clarify for me? Could the witness see Mr. Carter, and could Mr. Carter see the witness?
Your Honor, that's a very good question. So I can answer it I can answer the second part with certainty because I was in the courtroom with Mr. Stewart, and so we could certainly see the witness. What the witness could perceive is unknown, and I know the.
Why is it unknown?
Well, because there's certainly a two-way camera system in play. But what his camera was focused upon, we have no idea.
Did you ask him?
No, ma'am. Never asked him. And it's a good question. And so I would submit that our objection to his testimony via this methodology is enough to preserve any concerns regarding confrontation. I mean, it's not our job to say, gee, how's it set up? Are you doing it right? I mean, we have no way of knowing. Just as we had no way of knowing that he would be using a speech-to-text device on his phone. I mean, these were all unknowns to us.
You knew that during his testimony, right?
Yes, Justice DeWine.
So there's no reason you could not have, if that was the concern, that you could have raised that issue while he was testifying.
Which issue, sir? The issue regarding whether or not he could see the witness?
The speech-to-text issue that you just raised.
Well, we did raise that issue below. We objected.
You objected during his testimony?
Yes, sir. Actually, as it was going on, and the court indicated, well, and we even asked that it be turned off. And the trial judge said, no, I'm just going to ask him to rely primarily on his what he hears. So it was
right. Any reason to think that he didn't follow that instruction?
Well, plenty of reason. Well, no, actually, sir, the answer is there's no reason to believe that.
Well, the judge gave him an instruction. Generally, we presume that witnesses rely on the judge's instruction. Is there something in the record that you can point to that would show that he did not?
No, sir. There's nothing in the record. We'd have no way of knowing because he continued to look down at his phone throughout the testimony, but he wasn't prohibited from using it. The judge didn't say, turn it off, don't use it.
The judge told him to rely upon the written questions, right? To rely upon the questions, not the oral
question. Yeah, he said, I think the exact language was rely primarily on what you hear. So we would have no way to police that or know if he followed it or if anybody was even in the room with him.
But if there was a discrepancy, for example, his answer and the question, I mean, you would have a reason to think so.
No, sir. I mean, there would be no, to answer your question directly, there's no way for us to discern whether or not he followed the instruction or not.
Okay. And is there any reason to think, assuming you're right and there was an error, is there any reason to think it's not harmless?
Regarding his testimony remotely?
Correct.
Yes, sir. It could never be harmless. I mean,
well, that's not the law. The confrontation clause violations can be harmless error. There's plenty of case law on that.
Well, they could be if you get to the point where it's even an issue. So if you meet the necessity portion.
No, that's not the harmless error test, right? The harmless error test is different.
Yes, sir, it is much different. But in this case, we would submit that the mere presentation of evidence in this fashion is prejudicial.
So despite case law to the contrary, you think a confrontation clause violation is always prejudicial? It's one of the few places we have to presume prejudice.
No, sir. I believe that prejudice is an important element of the analysis. And in this case, the prejudice is clear because we were not allowed to confront this witness face to face.
But that's the prejudice in any confrontation clause violation.
Well, yes, sir, but before you would get to that, you would have already determined that most of those prejudice prongs would have been addressed. For example, in a child rape case, we don't want a child traumatized, and therefore we're willing to make the trade-off.
But that's not the child being traumatized is not prejudice. Prejudice means that that beyond a reasonable doubt, but for the confrontation clause violation, your client still would be convicted.
Yes, sir, but the problem is we have no way to point out if prejudice occurred. For example, if somebody else was in the room coaching him, if he was actually following court orders. I mean, if you were in the room with him, you could say, or if he was in the same courtroom, looking at the defendant and we looking at him, we could tell if there were any untoward activities occurring or if he continued to look at his text-to-speech translator.
I mean, so it sounds like you want us to adopt a presumption of prejudice.
No, sir. Under no circumstances do I wish you to adopt that. What I wish the court to do is what I know they'll do, and that's follow the Supreme Court precedent. And so the reality is that there's no reason to even, I would submit, consider the prejudice prong, because to allow testimony under these circumstances totally flies in the face of Maryland versus Craig. There's no reason to even have a prejudice analysis, because this should never be allowed in the first place. And to sanction this kind of remote testimony, Your Honor,
But again, if you say that it should never be allowed in the first place, and there's no reason to analyze prejudice, you're essentially adopting a presumption of prejudice.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with that notion. In a case such as this, there's absolutely no basis to allow remote testimony. So before you even get to a prejudice analysis, you have to figure out, was it lawful in the first place?
Well, but a prejudice analysis assumes it was not lawful, and then the question is, was the error harmless or not?
Yes, sir, and I appreciate that. And I don't mean to go round and round, and I'm certainly not arguing with you, but I'm suggesting that given the way this is set up, we can't even tell if prejudice existed, because we were, you know, 1,000 miles away from the witness, and all we could see was his face.
So what would your position be if there had been an interpreter there, if it was still remote, you had two screens, you had an interpreter so that interpreter had been duly sworn, you would have the assurance that the interpreter was accurately relaying the exact question that was being asked, and that the witness was understanding what was being asked? Where would we be at that point?
Justice Bruner, relative to that question, the use of the translation device is prohibited by the Ohio Revised Code. So that's an evidentiary.
I meant if there were a live interpreter, so that
yes, ma'am.
You had two screens that you could see what the interpreter was doing and what the witness was doing.
Yes, ma'am. It would still be unconstitutional because there's no finding of a case-specific necessity. There's the only reason that this was allowed was because travel was supposedly difficult, which isn't even supported by the record. But even if you acknowledge that travel was difficult, even so, Maryland versus Craig and all of its progeny says you still don't allow this. It's not permissible. You can't do it. So I understand Justice DeWine's concern about prejudice, like what's the harm, what's the fact. The harm is that to sanction this opens up a floodgate of cases that don't need to be heard and occupy our time in the justice system. I mean, this was a simple case. Bring him here, put him on a plane. And as the cases that we've cited ad nauseum say, if you can't get here now, come later. This is not a permanent disability where the man cannot show or the woman cannot show or the witness is unavailable. It was just inconvenient, and that's what the court found. And there's no massaging the entry to reach any other conclusion. And that's where our proverbial beef lies.
So the statistics about weather, COVID, and so forth that the Court of Appeals used, they weren't really in the record, were they?
They were not in the record. And had I argued that back in the day in front of Chief Justice Moyer or Alba Whiteside or Donna Bowman, they'd have looked at me like I was from the moon. They'd say, what are you talking about, Mr. Szymanski? You argue facts in the record. You don't argue outside the record. At least that's how I learned to handle appellate advocacy. You're confined to what happened in court. And there's a reason for that. And that's why the government is here asking you to consider the Third District's analysis about statistics that are all wrong. So of course we didn't have a chance to challenge that because it was never raised. And this is not about COVID. It was strictly about travel, Your Honor. I've gone way too long, and unless there are any other questions, I'll sit down and wait for Mr. Stewart to address the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Stewart.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice. Eric Stewart, Logan County Prosecutor for the state. Remote testimony has now been allowed for over three decades, starting with Maryland versus Craig. What has changed in that time is the technology. Technology has vastly improved. The ability to communicate over vast distances has made things much more convenient, but also makes things in times of necessity, makes that technology important and available to us.
Mr. Stewart, if we were to determine that the trial court's decision to allow remote testimony was more a matter of convenience than it was necessity, does that skew our analysis?
No, because in this case, it really wasn't for necessity or convenience. It was because of the COVID pandemic. Mr. Szymanski wants to make this all about travel. But in fact, the state's motion was, we asked for remote testimony because of the spread of COVID and because of the uncertainties of travel. The trial court cited to the pandemic at least four times in its decision and also mentioned COVID three times in its decision. It said the state's motion is well taken and granted it. So for them to state that this is all about travel and not about COVID is disingenuous. This was about COVID. We were in the middle of a COVID spike that had just occurred in January, was growing across the nation, and the state was concerned. It had an elderly witness in Minnesota and wanted him to be able to not have to be concerned about traveling to Ohio during the spread. And so we asked, that was our motion, to prevent COVID spread.
But why not have a camera that showed the entire area around him so that they could see whether he was being advised by notes or something? I mean, that's what I'm reading from their briefs, is they don't know if he was really alone, for that matter.
And there's, on the same side, there's no evidence that he wasn't alone.
I understand that. I'm just saying, wouldn't it have been better for the state to show everything in the room?
I can't answer that question. I don't know what, I know he was sitting in a chair. We all saw him sitting in a chair. He had his phone in front of him. There was no other noise or indication that there was anything else distracting him. There was no indication that he was reading notes while he was testifying.
Well, did anyone on the state side or even Mr. Carter's defense counsel ask about this or make questions, you know, Mr. Witness, are you in a room alone? Is anyone in the room with you? Do you have any notes other than what we can see in front of you? Are you relying strictly on your voice to text software? I mean, those sort of, if there were concerns, were they raised with the trial court?
I don't recall those specific issues being raised by either side. I know that prior to his testimony, before the jury was called in, the connection was made, Mr. Mullins had informed everyone in the court that he was relying on this text-to-speech captioning. Mr. Szymanski made his objection in the trial court. And this goes back to a previous question that you had. The trial court gave an order. The court is directing you that you must rely on the verbal communication that occurs during this hearing. Do you understand that? And the witness said yes. After that, there's absolutely no evidence that he disobeyed that order.
When he was asked if he needed that, the translation device, his response was he'd be more comfortable understanding the question with it. So in other words, confirming that what he heard was indeed what was asked, if he had this ability to see the question.
Yes, he did ask, because of his hearing disability, he asked if he could keep it on while he testified.
And was there anything in the record to indicate that he did not understand a question? For instance, if you asked, hypothetically, when did he tell you that information, and he said, I only do that on weekends.
Correct. All his responses were, they were responsive to the question. There's no indication that he misunderstood a question or was completely off base. All his answers were responsive.
So was the witness's inability to travel temporary or more permanent?
Well, I think all of us were in the position during COVID. We had no idea how long this was going to last. So his position, because we were in the middle of the pandemic, it was indefinite. We didn't know. Nobody knew when it was going to end, when it was going to be done. And that was our main reason for asking for his remote testimony.
This was 2022, more than 2 years after the show, or was it, what month was it again? February?
February, first week of February, so 2022.
Almost 2 years before the state shut down here.
Yeah, the CDC didn't declare the pandemic over until May of 2023.
And I know that was somewhat after the Omicron spike.
Correct.
But again, none of that was in the record in any definitive form, was it?
I think the court can take judicial notice of the fact that we were in the middle of a pandemic.
And the third district didn't specifically take judicial notice when it inserted all of those statistics, did it?
I believe it did. I think it took notice that the court could take judicial notice of those pandemic figures.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. If there was an error, was it harmless?
I believe it was, because there's not been any showing of prejudice in this case.
Well, they objected, so it's the state's burden to show that that there was no prejudice.
Right. And the testimony that was presented by Mr. Mullins indicated that he understood the questions, he presented them. The jury could view him, observe his demeanor, hear him. All of those things indicated that it was reliable testimony.
And if you exclude this testimony, what about the strength of the remaining evidence?
This case relied primarily on the victim's testimony that she was sexually assaulted by the defendant. That's the primary testimony. His testimony was corroborating evidence for the state regarding Eli Carter's admission to him that it had happened, but she was of age at the time.
Was there other similar corroborating evidence in the record?
Yes, there was another witness, a friend of Eli Carter, that had given testimony that he had had a conversation with Mr. Carter indicating that some sort of relationship had occurred between him and the victim. So I think...
What form did that take, Counselor, over here?
I'm sorry?
What form did that other witness's testimony take in terms of corroboration? What did he say?
He said that he had had a conversation with Eli Carter. At first, Eli Carter had denied the allegations to him. But a period of time had passed. They were having an additional conversation. His wife had brought up, aren't you going to tell him about the one incident or something that occurred? And at that point, he was stunned because everything up to that point had just been denial, denial, denial. But now we're talking about something had happened. That was the form of his testimony.
About consensual nature of the
testimony? About the consensual nature.
Yeah, yes. Okay.
All of the state's witnesses testified in person, except for just the one. Notice was given to all parties. An oath or affirmation was given to the witness. Live two-way audio and video. Everyone in the court could see and hear the witness and observe their demeanor. And the witness was subject to full cross-examination. The important state interest involved was the avoiding the spread of COVID-19 and protect the courtroom participants, avoid travel delays. I think the main difference between our position and the defense is that they're saying that the pandemic, COVID-19 just isn't enough. They needed to make more findings, and the state's position is no, COVID-19 was enough. That was an important state interest. Both the 8th District and the 1st District have already specifically held that preventing the spread of COVID-19 is an important public policy exception to the Confrontation Clause.
So how broad is that rule? Just any time a judge says COVID-19, you can suspend someone's Confrontation Clause rights?
No, there are still other factors.
Is there certain dates? I mean, because I mean, does it apply to other diseases?
Well, I mean, going back to Maryland versus Craig, what is the public policy interest? That case involved testimony of child abuse victims, having them testify. So,
but in Maryland, there were findings specific to that case. There wasn't just a blanket, anytime you say child abuse, that you can suspend the Confrontation Clause.
It's not about suspending the Confrontation Clause.
Well, suspending for that person.
I think they still have the right to confront the witness. It's just done remotely.
But Ohio's Constitution actually uses face-to-face in its verbiage.
And this court, in State versus Self, indicated that face-to-face confrontation is not the sine qua non of the Confrontation Clause.
I understand. But going back to Maryland versus Craig, I think in that case it also points out if a witness's inability to travel is temporary, the better procedure is a continuance. The better option is a continuance. What can you give me some idea why that wasn't a consideration?
I think it could have been an option. The state didn't ask for it. I think the defense could have asked for it. I think it probably would have been granted if they'd asked for it, but neither side was asking for a continuance. So,
when did you receive the ruling from the court that this was going to be permitted?
I believe it was just a day or two before the trial.
Court could have provided a better notice for them to make that assessment.
Well, I mean, the state filed its motion just like the week before, I believe. I don't know. So the court had contacted the parties and made its decision as quick as it could. There was also another question earlier about whether Eli Carter could view, or whether the witness could view Eli Carter, pardon me. In Logan County, we've been using the remote technology for all kinds of hearings, for pleas, sentencing. I'm familiar with the technology, and I was familiar with it that day. The witness can see the defendant, can see all participants in the court. The technology is such that it's kind of voice activated. So whoever's speaking into the speaker, the camera goes to that person or the table. In the case of Logan County, the courtroom there, the camera would go to defense counsel table where Mr. Eli Carter was sitting.
So it was face to face?
Yes. Yes. And I know that I can't point to anything in the record because that was not an issue ever raised by the defense. For the first time, they didn't even raise it in the third district, their objection to whether this was face-to-face or not. This is being raised first time here.
Excuse me, but I looked at the assignment of error, and there were two aspects to it. It's that remote means, speech-to-text captioning, and 14th Amendment. I don't see where it was not raised.
The specific issue of whether the witness could see Eli Carter in the courtroom.
Oh, I understand. Okay.
Has not been raised until this level.
Thank you.
Thank you. So earlier this year, the Supreme Court of Minnesota has arrived at the same conclusion that COVID-19 pandemic was a sufficient finding in as an exception to the Confrontation Clause. And the state has also cited
So we're going to have other cases. Help me understand the COVID-19 being a sufficient finding. Is that all a judge has to do is say, I think there's a risk of COVID-19 or people have COVID-19? Or what specifically could a judge do that today?
We're
getting COVID.
We're outside the pandemic now, so I don't know.
But your rule only applies to the state of emergency period?
The rule has to be an important public interest. And that foundation, that guideline is already there, and the trial court's going to have to make that determination. But I think it's already been established in child abuse cases. That is an important public policy reason. I think the COVID-19 pandemic
is it any spread of disease?
It potentially could be if the trial court makes that finding. But there are also other considerations that have to be made. And with a rule recently adopted, Criminal Rule 40, which permits remote testimony in all proceedings, if certain guidelines are met. So the state's not asking for any new guidelines. They are there. They're in Criminal Rule 40 that was recently enacted this year. And I think we can use those guidelines. The trial courts can use those guidelines to make sure the confrontation right is still protected, which is an important right. We ask the court to overrule the proposition of error. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, why not ask for a continuance?
That's a very good question. So, first of all, just so the timeline is squared away, the government moves on the 7th. We bust our proverbial tails. We get our motion filed the 8th. The court rules on the 8th, and trial starts the 9th. So the case is already 10 or 11 years old. It was one of these, wasn't even a delayed reporting situation. The government sat on the case for almost a decade. So everybody's ready to go. We're here. So we really didn't have, nor do I feel it really was our burden. This is their issue. If they thought that it was appropriate to continue, it should have been requested. But to be straight about the record, it was the 7th, motion ruled on the 8th, trial the 9th. And this, and Justice DeWine, you asked a good question. I really didn't answer it very well, frankly, when you said harmless error. But that's for the government to establish beyond a reasonable doubt. That's not our burden, but it's a good question, right? Like, no harm, no foul, maybe. But that's not the case here, sir.
Hasn't that been established here?
No, sir. Not even
Why not?
Close. Because it's all conjecture. Mr. Stewart says, well, maybe he was by himself. Maybe he had somebody there. All we could see was his face. We're not sure if he was using the text-to-speech or not. It's all up in the air.
Well, even in a live appearance, you don't know if that witness was coached 15 minutes before or outside the courtroom.
Justice Donnelly, that's 100% true. And given all the years you spent as a trial judge, you know what that dynamic is like in a courtroom. And most significantly, what I know is one thing. What a jury observes is paramount. Yeah, I may know a lot of things. I may have coached the daylights out of my witness if I'm doing my job, maybe. But that's not the issue. The issue here is the integrity of the system. And this process has pounced it on its head. And when Mr. Stewart says that this entry mentions COVID four times, well, it may mention it 100 times. But I live in the world of what the words say. And here the words couldn't be more clear. Under the fact-specific circumstances of this case, the court finds Mullins unavailable to testify in person.
unavailable. And as Justice DeWine says, how long does that unavailability last? Forever? No, of course not. He was available to testify. It was just difficult to travel.
Let me ask you this. Hypothetically, what if they established in the record that the witness, for whatever reason, his own health or someone he lived with, just was scared of traveling in general and just did not want to come in?
I think that's certainly a step in the right direction. Right, so that's a case-specific inquiry. Does it rise to the level of a necessity? Maybe. Or if he's immunocompromised, might be another way to ask it. You know, I don't want to run home and give my 85-year-old mother a dose of the virus. Of course not. So there are very real concerns. We're not asking you to ignore them. We're just asking that the record reflect what really happened, as it does here. And Mr. Stewart made a last-minute request. I can imagine why they didn't want to bring this man in. I don't think it had anything to do with his, it certainly didn't have anything to do with his health. It was a matter of convenience and probably.
What about resources? We don't have a unified system here in Ohio, and other certain jurisdictions have more of an ability to fly people in.
And I appreciate that, right, for sure. And that's a very real concern. And I know that in Logan County, as in many other smaller counties, there is a concern about plane tickets. I get that. But I would submit that the state of Ohio and the county of Logan can afford to follow the law. I think the downside is much more costly, as it were, certainly to Mr. Carter and I think to litigants everywhere. So lastly, and I know I've got about 45 seconds, I'll make it quick. There was no COVID spike. COVID had leveled. The only numbers that were submitted were set forth in our motion, which showed that COVID was level. Now, we're believers in being careful. Lucas and I, Mr. Trott and I, wore masks the whole time because I don't want to get sick. But nobody else in the courtroom did, and there were no precautions in place. It was a wide open trial. Jurors unmasked, witnesses unmasked, that's the reality. So, swinging back to Maryland versus Craig, we urge the court to do what we know it will, and that's follow the law. Thank you very much for hearing us.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.